Hello, and welcome back to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Your Insights. This episode, we're going to be going through a lot of funds. Funds are in the news, and Zach is with us to take us through all of that, the latest in the funds world. And also joining us via satellite connection from the other side of the country is Dila Chibici. Welcome, Dila.
Hi, Oliver, and hello from Bristol.
Thank you so much for calling in. And yeah, Dila is going to be talking us through some of her research in the last week around the end of life of renewable assets, recycling, and the circular economy. Look forward to that later. But as usual, we'll begin with the news. Zach, what have you got for us this time?
So several news stories came to my attention this week, and a couple of interesting exclusives directly to Inspiration. The first being further details emerging on Voltaire's debt financing. If you've been keeping up with the news earlier this month, Voltaire, through its subsidiary Helexia, closed the first tranche of its 90 million euro pan-European debt financing. Helexia, which was acquired by Voltalia in September 2019, confirmed that it structured a new debt package which will allow the company to finance its growth in France, Italy, Belgium, Portugal, Spain, Poland, Hungary, and Romania, and will support the competitiveness of its commercial offering to clients. The facility leverages a portfolio of 350 operating photovoltaic rooftop and solar carports located in four European countries. The financing is led by La Banque Postale and BPI France and is believed to be an equal split between the two lenders, with the tenor understood to be between 15 and 20 years.
So this was an exclusive for Inspiration, and Zach, I believe you spoke to the people involved. What did you find out?
Yeah, so we spoke to the Energy and Infrastructure Council at Voltalia, Samuel Bourdelot, and he told us that this transaction is notable in that it is, to our knowledge, the first time that such a diverse pan-European portfolio is financed on a limited recourse basis by commercial lenders, mixing energy efficiency projects with solar PV assets. He continued, saying it marks yet another example of the appetite seen amongst key market players in innovating to accelerate our energy transition. So I believe it's kind of indicative of a broader effort within the market to use different forms of finance to support the energy transition.
I think that's certainly true. And with such a diverse portfolio over all the countries you mentioned, I'm sure we're going to be seeing lots of the fruits of this fund in projects over the coming months and years. So one to keep an eye on. There's more news from the funds world, though.
Yes, indeed. The second notable story this week was Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, who hit the first close on their fifth flagship fund, Copenhagen Infrastructure 5. And this reached 5.6 billion euros in capital commitments received, with a target size of 12 billion euros in total, which was confirmed by CIP. The investment strategy is a continuation of their predecessor flagship funds, and the fund will focus on greenfield investments within large-scale renewable energy infrastructure. It has a global reach and intends to diversify investments across technologies such as contracted offshore wind, energy storage, onshore wind, and solar in low-risk OECD countries such as North America, Western Europe, and Asia Pacific.
So was there anything else that we were able to glean from CIP about their strategy for this new fund?
Yeah, so we spoke to them, and we actually learned that the investments will be split between three sections, with one-third in offshore, one-third in solar, and one-third in niche technologies. Niche technologies were confirmed to cover two categories: transmission lines to support renewable integration into the grid, and energy storage, specifically pump hydro and battery storage. In battery storage, this will extend to both standalone and co-located projects. And within transmission infrastructure, Inspiration has learned that CIP considers as part of broader supply chain investments in more general project investments. For example, within the floating wind sector, the project investment will include money sent directly to develop cabling arrays and transmission infrastructure. The fund already has the largest project pipeline to date. At first close, it owns over 40 renewable energy infrastructure projects with a potential commitment of approximately 20 billion euros, corresponding to more than 150% of the target fund size.
There's even more funds news. Tell us more.
Teleri Energia has reached first close on its International Solar Wind Free Fund with approximately 286 million euros in commitments. The first close investors include the Akitia Free Fund, the European Investment Fund, Varma Mutual Pension Insurance Company, Teleria, the Teleria Energia team, Finnish pension funds, foundations, endowments, family offices, and individual investors were strong supporters of the fund, investing through Atakia Free. The fund will be seeded with a portfolio of 50 development projects acquired from Teleria Energia by the fund at first close. The projects have a total capacity of 7.7 gigawatts if they all reach ready-to-build status, with the target markets in the Nordics and Baltics, Poland, Southeast Europe, Spain, and Texas. The fund's investment strategy is to acquire, develop, contract, construct, operate, and exit a portfolio of utility-scale onshore wind farms, solar parks, and battery storage assets.
Thank you, Zach. And again, that's another fund which is looking over quite a broad regional spread there in the places it's interested in developing those projects.
Yeah, indeed. I think Finland was one of the major interests of the fund. And if we've been looking at the Finnish market quite a lot recently, as it's seen significant investment. Finland has always been dominated by hydropower, with around 41% of total renewable energy installed in 2019, that of hydropower. However, wind energy has become one of the predominant forms of renewable energy within the market. It is the second largest source of renewable energy and has a growth of around 55% in terms of electricity generation. We had a Q&A recently with one of the biggest players within the Finnish wind market, Elias Wind. And we learned that the quick technological development with higher tip heights and larger rotors has opened up Finland as a market where wind projects can provide really competitive projects, driving continued investment within the market.
Finland, of course, is a really interesting emerging market, not just for onshore wind, but for offshore too. And this year, we've seen the financial close of Finland's first flagship offshore wind farm, a very significant move in that market. And wrapping up the news this week, we've got some big news from Brookfield.
Yeah, so Brookfield Asset Management has revealed details about its investment strategy as it pivots towards green hydrogen. The company has revealed it is looking to make investments in battery storage, green hydrogen, and carbon capture. For Brookfield, the key investment sectors are determined by factors including size and maturity. The company wants to invest in new technologies like hydrogen over established sectors like electric vehicles and wind because of the higher level of risk and uncertainty surrounding nascent industries could lead to higher IRRs. The manager has noted that hydrogen is not a new technology. Rather, recent developments have made the generation more scalable. For hydrogen, the US, particularly Texas, Canada and the Nordics are attractive regions, while Chile has become an interesting area for the future.
Once again, it's interesting to see here that they have lumped together green hydrogen with carbon capture and storage. I think we're seeing that evolve a lot more in the hydrogen strategies of companies going forward. It's now got much more policy support from countries like the UK, where those models are being supported, and, as you mentioned, the US and the Nordics.
Indeed.
Thank you, Zach. We now turn to the thorny issue of what to do when an energy asset runs out of steam at the end of its life. This is obviously a lot more complicated in some fields, nuclear perhaps being the biggest example of a difficult end of life. But how difficult is it for renewables? And, well, with the massive acceleration in renewable output in the last few years, this is only going to be moving up and up the agenda. Looking into this in the past week has been our analyst, Dila Jibici.
Yes, that's right, Oliver. So as you already mentioned quite rightly, that the world has been rapidly sort of expanding its renewable energy network over the last few years, and it is now beginning to face its first major wave of retired solar PV panels and also wind turbines. And in order to ensure a sustainable trajectory for them, even at the end of their life, circularity becomes a big issue here, and it must be really ingrained within their supply chain as these wind and solar installations especially also gain momentum in the race towards achieving the energy transition we're working hard towards too. So And especially if these recycling processes are not conducted in a sustainable way, these retired panels and turbines could actually end up contributing to a huge waste problem. And the recycling industry for these renewable energy assets is still very much in its infancy and does, in fact, require a lot more investment and regulatory support as well.
So help us quantify how big the problem is at present. How much are we expecting, as you were hoping for huge growth in the renewable sector, but sort of in numbers of terms of how many gigawatts and how many solar panels we're expecting? Do we have an idea of the sort of scale of that demand?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we have estimates, obviously. And the International Energy Agency predicts that the cumulative solar PV installed power is actually expected to end up surpassing that of coal, that of coal's power capacity by 2027, which is obviously a great thing. And the installations of solar panels is estimated to grow by almost 1,500 gigawatts between 2022 and 2027. Currently, it's contributing just under 15%. It is expected to rise further to 22.2% by 2027, whereas wind is also expected to double its power capacity over that period. And we're expecting to see a growth for both onshore and offshore wind here. So taken together, actually, solar and wind power is estimated to more than double over the next 5 years, which will eventually lead to contributing around 20% of global power generation by 2027. So there's going to be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of more solar panels and wind turbines around the globe, really.
Yeah, that is... It almost seems too simple to point out, but 570 gigawatts of wind capacity is an absolutely huge number. I think that was 570 gigawatts of onshore wind,
yes,
in particular.
That's right.
And you've got to remember, onshore wind is typically smaller, under 10 megawatts, even at the high end. So you're talking about there at least sort of 50, 60,000 individual wind turbines, which is a huge demand on resources, not even going near offshore wind there or the incredible expected growth in solar demand.
Now, exactly. And that's an additional capacity that's being expected to be added. So that's on top of all the ones that are currently around as well.
So with those ones which are currently around, how long do we expect those to be useful for? When are we going to actually start running into the problem of the current crop of wind and solar assets coming to the end of their lives?
Yeah, so that's basically happening right about now. So for solar panels and wind turbines, they're actually pretty similar, but solar panels have a slightly longer lifespan compared to wind turbines. The average lifespan for solar PV installations is around 25 to 30 years, whereas a modern wind turbine will generally last about 20 to 25 years. Of course, this is hugely dependent on environmental factors they're operating within, and also the maintenance procedures that are being followed, after which they're then taken out of action and then often end up in landfills.
We're talking a lot about solar and wind, but obviously they're very different technologies but growing in tandem. So let's start by looking at solar specifically. So what are the challenges of dealing with solar panels at the end of their useful lives?
So by some estimates, there are currently some 2.5 billion solar panels around the world, which could lead to over 200 million tons of scrap metal by 2050. That will somehow be dealt with, either be it by recycling or disposal. And as I said, the solar recycling and the wind as well is still in its nascency. So it is gearing up towards dealing with its first wave of retired panels here. And some companies have introduced some innovative techniques towards resolving this issue. One of them is ROSI, which is a special solar recycling company operating in Grenoble, France. And it is aiming to extract and reuse almost all of the components of a panel. And this is also among the first facilities, if not the first one around the world, I think, that is solely dedicated to the full recycling of solar panels. And if they actually did manage to extract all of these critical materials that are contained within solar panels, which do include materials such as silicone, copper, and silver, which are considered to be critical materials and are highly sought after, and will become increasingly more important towards the energy transition as demand rises for these sorts of technologies. If they ended up being able to extract them, they could not only help to reduce the waste issue, but they also could contribute towards manufacturing new panels in a more speedy manner. Now, of course, this is an incredibly expensive endeavor, and it will need to be scaled up tremendously in order to actually service and recycle all the incoming panels. So there is still a long, long way to go, but these are obviously good signs towards some sort of viable solutions that will actually not only help the issue, but alleviate some of the pressures we might face in the future as well.
How important is it to reclaim these critical minerals which are going into the production of solar panels for the future? Because obviously there's increasing pressure on supply chains, particularly in these kind of rare earths required for the energy transition.
Yes. So critical materials actually do play a hugely important role within the energy transition, because they are basically the enabling materials within these renewable energy technologies that allow them to produce the energy they do. And one of the issues is that a lot of the production and processing is really, really focused and concentrated within China. And as I'm sure everyone is aware, there are sort of these growing tensions with China, with the West, with the United States and Europe in particular. So it'll be critically important to actually be able, for the world really, to diversify their access to critical minerals. And it'll require a lot more investment here as well.
So I suppose this all comes into the onshoring of these supplies. Obviously, if you have an additional source of these minerals, even if it's not necessarily the most economical way of doing it for the sake of energy security, there's an argument for investing in this technology.
Definitely, definitely. One of the issues with nearshoring is that you can only nearshore where the actual materials are. So this will require geological expeditions and mining projects, but for a mining project to realistically take off and produce something, it'll take at least a decade. So there's also some analysts that say, instead of maybe focusing on mining, maybe we need to just create parallel structures, not necessarily disturb and take away from China, but support and generate alongside it, because ultimately this will benefit everyone.
Okay, we've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole there on supply chains, but that, I think, crucial points we need to cover. Let's bring it back to wind and solar recycling. So we've talked about the efforts happening in the solar sector. What about wind? Like, instinctively, I think that a wind turbine is simpler than a solar panel. So is that less of an issue?
I mean, similar, but I suppose slightly less of an issue. So 90% of a wind turbine is actually quite easily recycled, but the fiberglass blades of that turbine tell a different story here. They account for about 10% of the asset's mass, but that's also the part that requires the most action and attention as well. And the waste generated here is projected to be around 43 million tons by 2050. So it's a huge amount that we need to be ready to deal with. The problem here is that the blades are manufactured with layers of a composite material like epoxy resin, which is an incredibly resilient substance that is quite difficult and costly as well to break down into reusable components, though it is mostly considered to be non-toxic. They can also often end up being sent to landfills and be incinerated. Here, again, obviously, we do have some innovation going on. And one of the more promising developments, let's say within the year especially, has been Vestas, a Danish company that's focusing on renewable energy equipment manufacturing, which has unveiled a partnership solution with Olin and Stena Recycling early this year. So this solution basically allows these blades to be recycled without having to change their design or the materials involved, which is also another approach companies have been taking, looking into how maybe the materials can be replaced in order to avoid using these more difficult materials that are more challenging to deal with, especially at the end of their life. So this chemical technology promises to break down the blades in a liquid, allowing the resulting materials to be reused, basically. Other companies that actually go back to 2020 is Veolia, which is a research management company that is headquartered in France, but has opened a facility in Missouri in the United States. And there they store the wind turbine blades in a quarry and then eventually shred them. These then are sold to cement makers who can use the shredded wind turbine material as fuel that replaces the coal they would have used instead. And this is said not to only cut down carbon dioxide emissions, but it has also reduced their water consumption. There's all of these approaches that are being researched and implemented and try to be scaled up now, but they do signal a step change, which is fundamentally necessary in order to sustain these sorts of technology installations. But it will still, as I said, require huge investments and to enable the scaling of this industry and the maturing of it.
So there's a lot of promising technology, promising new techniques out there for, I suppose, extracting more value out of the end of life of these assets than there might appear to be at first glance. I suppose that's what the whole circular economy idea is about. And so with that in mind, what would you say are the sort of most essential steps for the coming few months and years?
So one of the bigger complaints within the industry is that in order to enable the circularity of these technologies, these industry experts and leaders do call for a lot more government guidance. And there is, and it's growing, and attention has been increasing. However, just a lot more needs to be done. and the expectation is that a lot more mandates and regulations around the recycling needs to be introduced. That includes waste classification, data collection, reporting, and recycling mandates. And that includes a close collaboration between public and private sectors that is essential in order to create the favorable conditions for investments. That also involves that solutions such as burying, burning, and landfilling need to be entirely basically replaced almost in order to promote the reuse of these components and the appropriate waste management procedures. If we do fail to address this sort of impending end-of-life problem, there is a risk that the progress that has been made through these renewable energy assets, that it is going to be undermined somewhat. So it is important for governments and companies alike to collaborate and take proactive steps to create a sustainable future for these energy assets. Hopefully a lot more investment and policy direction will be coming in the future, and we'll make sure to cover it.
Thank you, Dila. I think that there's a lot of skepticism when it comes to end of life and waste management. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, if it's cheaper and easier to get rid of waste by shipping it somewhere else, somewhere that doesn't cost, that tends to be the solution that in most of the economy prevails. But I think the point you made about making technologies investable, including them in the whole renewable economy, is very key. If we can't get to a place where sustainability is investable, then I think we're in real trouble.
Yeah, that's entirely correct. And I guess it's important to remember that we've tried the landfill, and it's, you know, it's helped us get to this point. So maybe it would be smart to try and avoid that sort of approach in the future. But Oliver, you've recently written about how solar panels are actually performing, particularly in these rising temperatures. I think it's been reported that this has been, these last few weeks have been the hottest on record ever. So what were some of your findings about this?
Yes, I think this is, I think it's becoming something of a tradition in the UK media, at least. I've not seen this anywhere else, but I suspect it's happening elsewhere as well, where we get to the hottest period of the summer. I think it was just the end of June that we've just had. It was incredibly hot temperatures in here in the UK. We're not built for it, but there was a story in the Times about how in the midst of summer, solar was underperforming. So in the time where you would expect there to be the the biggest peaks in solar generation, the generation was actually being hampered by the heat itself, reducing the efficiency of the solar panels, and we're actually not producing any more energy than we were back in April.
Okay.
So I think that this kind of narrative, it sticks a bit because there are grains of truth in it. But the conversation that tends to take place around these kind of slightly insightful articles tends to go down the road of, well, why are we investing in renewables anyway if they can't even perform on the days when there's the most sunshine?
So, but that, surely that's not true, is it?
Well, it's partly true. So okay, let's talk about how solar panels actually work. So that is a peak in the performance of solar panels as they're deployed in the UK. Obviously, there's different standards around the world. Different environments need different amount. But in the kind of panels that you'll put up in the UK for the purpose of generating energy, they have an ideal operating temperature around 25 degrees centigrade.
Okay. Does that mean after that they're struggling to absorb some of the heat?
Well, yes, partly. So going over 25 degrees centigrade, for every degree above that, you start to see a drop-off in performance of about 0.34 percentage points in efficiency terms. That's figures from Solar Energy UK. That's even an improvement on designs from only a couple of years ago, where it was more typically to see a drop-off of 0.5% per degree above ideal temperature. But in the grand scheme of things, that's relatively small. Now, the claim about peak generation is true. So we looked over every day of 2023 so far using data from National Grid ESO, the electricity system operator, and we found that it's true that the day of highest peak generation for solar in the UK was the 20th of April, where we surpassed 10.1 gigawatts of solar power being produced at one moment. That was the reading of 12:30, their half-hourly reports. And that is higher than the recent peaks during the sort of hottest days, where it only came up to about 9.8, 9.9 gigawatts in the UK generation. However, that's not necessarily the same thing as saying that solar power was generating more power in April, because obviously in the summer you've got more hours in the day where you can use a solar panel. You go up in the terms of the gigawatt hours being produced, even if not in the sort of peak capacity itself. So back in April, on that day when it was well reported that that was the peak day, and National Grid ESO has a little table where they sort of keep track of all the records that have been broken. On that day, we've estimated that about 75 gigawatt hours of solar power was put into the grid, which is huge. That's a fantastic amount. But if you look at some of the days with lower peaks in the midst of the recent heat wave at the end of June, we saw that the actual peak in terms of energy generated was on the 14th of June, where we had 83.5 gigawatt hours of energy being put into the grid. And so, yes, the narrative around, okay, the peak efficiency is down a little bit because the air temperature is up a bit, and that does have an impact on the solar panels. Yeah, maybe it doesn't get up to the peak in cooler temperatures, but there's still a lot more energy being produced. 10 gigawatt hours more energy being produced on a single day is a significant contribution to the national grid. Yes, on the one hand, the peak generation wasn't met, but there was more energy total generated during the summer months.
So does that mean it's not necessarily the intensity of the sun, but maybe the duration and the intensity of sun exposure that's
Exactly.
determining more sort of the output of electricity generation?
Exactly, yes. So it's a combination of the amount of time the sun is shining for and the intensity.
Well, I'm glad we put that myth to bed then.
The common problems with solar panels often stated is, yes, all this energy generation is happening in the peak of a day, which does tend to be the peak in demand. That peak generation was ideally placed. As solar becomes a bigger and bigger part of the energy mix of the UK, we are going to need more investment in those energy storage technologies, those things that can move the peak of generation later into the evening when we have the drop-off inevitably in solar generation. And also, there are other solutions that are looking at incentivizing moving electricity demand to the parts of the day where renewable electricity will be more abundant. Part of the REMA market review is all about making sure that both in terms of location and time, power generation and power demand are much more in line with one another.
I mean, just like you say, I think it's part of this the energy transition is that it's a quite a holistic approach that needs to be taken. It's not only sort of the generation, but it is the co-location of battery storage that then needs to be improved as well to be able to store the energy for much longer, but then also maybe looking to demand management and how that can be maybe spread out a lot more and distributed a bit more evenly. So all of those things together, really.
On that, we'll wrap it up for today. Thank you so much for calling in, Dila.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me, Oliver.
And Zach, thanks once again for the news update.
Pleasure, Oliver.
And that's it for us for another week. We are taking a brief break now for the couple of weeks during the middle of the summer, although we will be back in no time with more news and analysis. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.